From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. It's Wednesday, and as usual, our focus is on politics. The race for governor is in full swing, with both sides making it clear it will be a negative and nasty campaign. What isn't clear is if the list of candidates is complete. Three-time Republican gubernatorial candidate Bob Vanderplaats continues to weigh running as an independent this fall. Can he pose a serious threat to Terry Branstad, or is it a last-ditch effort to remain relevant? Meanwhile, in Washington, the race is on to adopt a financial reform bill before the holiday recess, but some say the bill is all bark and no bite. And finally, while the Senate debates reining in Wall Street, unemployment benefits for workers are running out. Should they be extended again? Hear from our political experts and tell us what you think next on Talk of Iowa. But first, the news. Good morning. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck, and it's Politics Day. My guests are Rachel Caulfield, Drake University Professor of Politics and International Relations, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Ladies, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Well, over the weekend, Republicans failed to fully unite behind June primary winner Terry Branstad. Now, Branstad, of course, was nominated, but his pick for Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds faced a challenge from both Bob Vanderplaats and Rod Roberts. She did come away with a nomination, but Vanderplaats continues to withhold his support and threatens to run as a third-party candidate. Rachel, let me begin with you. Is this just sour grapes, or does he think he has a shot?
Well, I can't imagine that he thinks he has a shot as an independent candidate. And in fact, I think as an independent candidate, he runs the risk of dividing the Republican base. He has to know that. And I think that's why he's weighing his options very carefully right now. I don't think it's sour grapes. I think there are legitimate policy differences here. You've heard talk for a long time about this divided Republican Party. It's never been on display more than it is right now. The fact that the party can't easily unite around Branstad as the nominee tells us a lot about where the Republicans in Iowa are.
But Vanderplaats has run three times now, has never secured his party's nomination. Now, in his defense, the first time he didn't win, the second time he pulled out of the race to join the ticket with Jim Nussel. Rumors has it that he had asked Vanderplaats to, or excuse me, asked Branstad to be on the ticket, and Branstad said, Jim Nussel tried that, and Bob, it didn't work. It didn't bring him enough of Western Iowa to secure the win, and I can't go that route. I have to go for moderates and independents in the general election. So is it just a matter of the fact, I mean, because like you said, he's not won the party's nomination, and he can't likely win in a third party. So what's the goal here then?
I'm not sure what the goal is. And you saw some top Republicans over the weekend talk about Terry Branstad's oversized ego.
But I feel like that's a little bit the case with Bob Vanderplaats possibly at this stage in the game. You've lost three times. At what point do you say, okay?
And I'm sorry, I should have said talk about Vanderplaats' oversized ego. I'll correct myself there.
Can I remind you, Bella Abzug has this wonderful quote, you have to lose, lose to win. And most people lose elections. They don't win elections. Mm-hmm. And losing, there's no loss of dignity because you lose. I mean, you're talking to someone who's lost twice and people keep begging me to run again. So trust me, I've been the loser camp
sure.
more than I want to remember. And I also, in defense of Vanderplaats, I think what he's seeing is because of what's happening with the Tea Party movement, because there is this real frustration within the Republican Party, the question is, how do you clean house? Yes, Terry Branstad may have won the nomination, but is that good for what he believes is the true core values of the conservative Republican Party? And in a way, yes, it might be a kamikaze mission because he will lose and Branstad may lose, but maybe what he's also saying is he's making a point, is that we can't rally around moderation. That will only destroy the party. What we ultimately have to do is figure out what that conservative message is, rally around that, and bring it forward. And the party is changing. I mean, it changed in the 90s and became very fundamentalist Christian. Then George Bush won and it became very corporate. Now we're seeing Vanderplaats, especially on the social issues, talking about the fact that, you know what, maybe we walked away from our values, and appealing to moderates and independents is a strategy to win an election, but not a strategy to define a party.
And we'd like
that's
you to join. Yeah. We'd like you to join our conversation today. Call 1-866-780-9100. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPRTalk. Again, the phone number, 866-780-9100. There are some that are, have said that Vanderplas is looking for a promise of a job in the administration. That's very common, Arnie, right? That if
that would be more disgusting. but if he does that, then he has no political future. Because then what is he doing? He is not talking about the party. He's all about me, myself, and I. Now, I understand ego in politics because, frankly, you have to have an oversized ego to even get into the political arena. So that's not a problem. But if you start doing this bartering stuff where, you know, you threaten an independent run because that's your way of securing a position, then it's really not about independence. It really is about, you know, job security. And nobody values that outside of the political arena. I mean, if John Q. Public looks at that and says that feels like a form of prostitution, that doesn't sound like good government or good policy.
And I should say these are coming from people that have told me this, not from the Vanderplas camp himself.
Well,
I want to make that clear that I don't know that's happening for sure. One of the other interesting things, Rachel, was that Kim Reynolds was selected.
Yes.
And this is the first time the three of us have kind of been able to talk about her selection as the nominee. Were you surprised? She's a former Clark County Treasurer, served four terms from Osceola, was in her first term in the Iowa Senate, served 2 years before being tapped to run with Branstad. Is this what do you think of this pick?
Well, it's an interesting choice. I think it, first of all, you know, I think it's fair to say that Reynolds is a clean slate. Not a lot of people know a lot about her. And in many ways, that's the safest possible pick for Branstad right now. I mean, he's facing this rift between the fiscal conservatives and the social conservatives. And in choosing Reynolds, I think there's an effort to kind of mold her into the kind of lieutenant governor candidate that he needs her to be. There's been talk about the fact that, you know, she's always been seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, which may be true. But if you look at her record in the state in the state Senate, she's been pretty mainstream Republican down the line. Social conservatives are calling her pretty clearly a fiscal conservative, pretty clearly in the Branstad camp. So they're not completely happy. Fiscal conservatives, I think, have embraced her. Branstad, in his announcement of his choice, he was very careful to choose a wide range of Republican leaders, including social conservative leaders across the state. But then you have significant disagreements and displeasure among the social conservatives. I want to go back to Branstad or to Vanderplas for just a minute. I think one of the things that he's trying to do is, with the choice of Reynolds, I think he's trying to keep his voice in the conversation. He sees legitimate issues and legitimate policy differences, and he's trying to figure out how he can express those. He will obviously be a major player as Republican candidates come out for the 2012 campaign. And so keeping his voice out there, and particularly being able to rally those social conservatives, is incredibly important to him right now.
And if he doesn't keep that voice strong, Arnie, can he have any, you know, impact in 2012? Is that part of what this is about, remaining relevant?
Oh, I think that's the whole problem for people in New Hampshire and in Iowa. New Hampshire and Iowa don't just talk about gubernatorial politics and congressional politics. They're always playing the presidential politics card. It gets in the way of local politics because you don't just see what's happening for you now. You see what's happening for you vis-a-vis your relationship with a presidential candidate. So I think Vanderplas is looking at that. But let me just also go back to the senator, because my understanding is that Senator Reynolds is, you know, pro-life. She is pro-traditional marriage. She is for limited taxation. I mean, when you look at all these things, a lot of things that Vanderplas, you know, claims to be and probably is a lot of things that Kim Reynolds, at least, can claim and wrap herself around. So I think that that's something to hold on to, because I think that that's important. She does step a little bit on his message.
Let me throw out the phone number real quick, and we're going to go back to this. But we would love for you to join our conversation. What do you think of the choices of Kim Reynolds as Branstad's pick as lieutenant governor candidate? 1-866-780-9100. Email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Again, 866-780-9100. Is this a solid pick? Would a Vanderplas run hurt Branstad or be irrelevant? One of the things that surprised me right after the pick was that there was, you know, newspapers now have abilities for viewers to type in comments at the bottom. And immediately one of the comments was, oh, the Republican strategy of choosing eye candy. And I don't know if you've seen her, Arnie. She's an attractive 50-year-old woman, lean and dark-haired.
Yeah. And I felt like Scott Brown was eye candy. No, Scott Brown. Honest to God, when Scott Brown, I know Scott Brown. I've known Scott Brown 5 years ago. Scott Brown is a very interesting senator that got elected out of the state of Massachusetts to replace Ted Kennedy. Are you reading this? And the thing that about Scott Brown is, you need to know, when I first interviewed Scott Brown 4 years ago, the guy who was basically encouraging me to interview him said, oh, but Arnie, he's easy on the eyes. I mean, so, but, you know what? Attractiveness can go both ways.
But I felt like that was a knock on her in the sense that he hadn't picked her for abilities or hadn't. And look, it sort of discouraged me that you can't be both qualified and attractive. You know, people are negative against Hillary Clinton about wearing pantsuits, but then we attack Sarah Palin for wearing skirts and heels. At what point do we let these women just be candidates, Rachel? I mean, I find that a bit discouraging.
Well, I'm not sure we let anybody just be candidates. This is a media-saturated culture, and you know, attractive people do well on the campaign mm-hmm. trail. Attractive people who are charismatic and qualified, so much
do even better.
Yeah, that's great. But look, I mean, I think she balances Branstad in a lot of ways. She's young and vibrant. She's an up-and-comer in the party. She's a woman. So I think she signals a lot of things. But people are chosen for their demographic factors all the time. People are chosen for their, you know, for their appearance. There is an actual study that demonstrates that there is such a thing as presidential hair.
So we will not have a bald president?
No, we will not.
You don't have it, Arnie?
No, I'm so upset.
But let me ask. Go ahead, Arnie.
There is no question. Looks matter, because looks can also marginalize you. When I was running, I had short, dark hair. I had this sort of aggressive personality. So immediately people put me into a certain category, and they put me into an ethnic category. They put me into a sexuality category, and it was based on my looks. It turned out that 9 out of 10 things they put me into were not correct. But we use looks in a lot of ways, both as an asset and as a liability, and also a way to play to marginalizing people. Sarah Palin, you know, is from a lot of my feminist friends, is more marginalized because she is attractive. Mm-hmm. You know, they look at her charisma and say it's all about her you know, her looks. And there's got to be some, you know, political savvy there, because she's done a heck of a lot and with her looks that go far beyond it. So I do think you can't get away from it. And the problem is that, you know, more and more women that are on the bench will make it more and more possible for us to point out the cute women, the short women, the, you know, the pantsuit women, and then eventually we'll figure out who's the most qualified candidate.
Well, let's hope that comes quickly. We're going to take a quick break. We want you to join our conversation this morning about Iowa politics, and we're going to turn to some national issues later in the program as well. 1-866-780-9100. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or tweet us this morning, IPR Talk. Join our conversation on Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. This is Iowa Public Radio News. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. It's Politics Day. We're discussing politics with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and Rachel Caulfield, Drake University Professor of Politics and International Relations. We're hoping that you join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. Before we move away from some of the Iowa politics, anything that I didn't get to that's kind of been out there, Rachel? I know that one thing that was brought up about Kim Reynolds, the pick for lieutenant governor, is whether she was qualified, whether she had enough experience. Yet I look at Tom Vilsack's pick of Sally Peterson, who, when she was selected, had no political experience, came from the private sector, was sort of active in autism programs and research and funding because she has a son with autism. And that first year, you know, that they took office, it would have been a shock if something had happened to the governor, because I'm not sure how prepared the lieutenant governor might have been. And that's not a knock on her, because by 8 years later, she'd have been just fine. But my point is, when people complain about Kim Reynolds' experience, many times the lieutenant governor pick, you know, is not as experienced as the person running.
Well, no, and
except for maybe Patty Judge, who had more than Chet Colbert.
Exactly. you know, the lieutenant governor, just like the vice president of the United States, the lieutenant governor's job is whatever the governor wants it to be. Lieutenant governors can be extremely involved in politics and extremely involved in policy, or they can kind of sit on the back bench and, you know, watch and learn and maybe someday be put to good use.
Well, let me ask you about that, because largely since we changed the way lieutenant governors were selected, they ran separately. Now they're on the same ticket. Branstad is sometimes knocked now, although this wasn't odd at the time, but for not using his lieutenant governor as much as then later governors like Tom Vilsack, who made Sally Peterson a much more integral part of his administration. Chet Colbert has made Patty Judge a much more integral part. And in fact, she heads the Department of Homeland Security. Yeah. So, I mean, they've become a larger role. And now, can Branstad go backwards? Does he have to give her a larger role because of that precedent?
No, I think it's fair to say it's completely up to Branstad, how he chooses to use her and where she feels comfortable.
Okay.
You know, that's a negotiation that they will engage in. And to a large extent, it will be outside of public view.
All right. Let's talk to Jerry.
Go ahead, Arnie.
There are
a lot of people that end up in political life that have never, ever been in politics. I mean, we can look at the two females in California who are now acquiring their seat in California. They've never done politics. They haven't even voted. You know, I mean, it's like, isn't it interesting? All of a sudden we're talking about, you know, is Ms. Reynolds prepared? Does she have enough under her belt? Yada, yada, yada. Well, if she had enough money, nobody would be asking that question because she's obviously, I mean, look at Mayor Bloomberg in New York. I mean, no one even knew what party he was in. So experience
and that was part of
in government
in a way.
Pardon me?
And that was almost part of the attraction.
Well, exactly. And experience in government sometimes is a negative, not a positive. Like we said, she has kind of a blank slate. And what we want is a citizen legislature. What we like about democracy is that you don't have to be a king or a queen or a Kennedy or a Bush in order to get elected. It's not part of your family values, and it may also not be part of your history, because we have this quirky idea that somehow, you know, you can lead not because of that, you know, that connectedness to politics. So it's not necessarily necessary. But before we leave the female line, someone sent me an email as we were talking. And I just want to let you know that Kathleen Parker, who is this relatively conservative columnist, has just written a piece, and it's entitled Obama, Our First Female President. So I just – and she – and he's saying –
We've made it to the White
this,
House and we didn't even know it.
Really?
Exactly. And she said if Bill Clinton was our first black president, as Toni Morrison once proclaimed, then Barack Obama may be our first woman president. And the rationale is that he isn't cowboy enough. Mm-hmm. And that in that, and that, remember how people keep saying, what are you going to lead? Where's your backbone? You're trying to reach consensus. You're trying to reach across the aisle. We all have all these expectations. And a lot of those expectations are in part what women historically have sort of claimed that they could bring to the table. And all of a sudden now, Kathleen is saying Obama may be our first female president. I just want you to know that maybe Terry Branstad read that column, so he wants to make sure that he doesn't have to worry about it because he's got Ms. Reynolds right next to him.
Well, let's talk to Jerry in Mason City. Jerry, thanks for calling Talk of Iowa.
Good morning. Well, I have three comments to make about Reynolds, and this is her record. She announced when she was picked by Branstad that she was ready to take over the governor's chair. Yet she has been arrested twice for drunk driving. She's against gay marriage, and she's against abortion. And I don't believe that Iowa is that stupid or that conservative to vote for Branstad or Reynolds.
All right, Jerry, let's discuss Jerry's remarks. You know, the issue of being against same-sex marriage and, you know, against abortion is not shocking as the pick of the Republican Party lieutenant governor candidate. And the issue of the drunk driving convictions in the 90s, does that hurt her or does that in fact make her seem more accessible? What does that do? Because these aren't as recent as, you know, a couple of years ago. President Bush had convictions on his record and was elected president. Rachel?
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that she announced it. She was upfront about it. She said she had, you know, dealt with alcoholism. So, excuse me. you know, she got it off the table as a political issue. Now, for some people, that's not going to be enough. Mm-hmm. And the drunk driving arrests are going to continue to be a big deal for her. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that those people are people who typically would not have voted for her anyway. So, you know, it's in the past. I think she dealt with it, got it out of the way. On the issues of abortion and gay marriage, again, Branstad is trying to reach out to the conservative base and kind of take some of the wind out of the sails of a Vanderplaats and a Roberts, be a little conciliatory, unite the party. Those are positions that are absolutely essential in that role. And particularly, you know, on the anti-gay marriage front, you know, let's remember that we have a lot of Republicans in Iowa and independents and some Democrats in Iowa who are very upset about gay marriage. We have judges on the ballot in November. And, you know, Branstad has a limited ability to speak out on that issue because he appointed the author of the Varnum decision. So choosing somebody who is publicly anti-gay marriage, I think, was a pretty good choice on his part.
All right,
okay,
let's
just
real quick.
Real quickly, Senator Reynolds, mm-hmm. you asked how he's going to use his lieutenant governor. Maybe not a lot. And then on the second point, I think Terry Branstad is running on the economy and on jobs and repairing the state and getting our fiscal house back in order. So all those comments about Senator Reynolds are true. But that doesn't mean that is going to define this governor's race, that this is going to define him as governor, because I think really what you see with Terry Branstad is someone who wants to focus on it's the economy, stupid. And there may be other things that a lot of people are going to disagree with, but I don't think they're going to rise to the top 10 issues that the Branstad administration wants to deal with, will be dealing with, and is going to repair what needs to be repaired in Iowa.
All right, let's talk to Kevin real quick in Greenfield, try to squeeze in another call before the break. Kevin, thanks for calling the Talk of Iowa today.
Thanks, and great show. I really don't believe it. The perception is that the Republicans are completely divided. I would say that's furthest from the fact when you consider Culver. And also, when you look at the two conventions, the Republican Party is more Democratic than the Democrat Party, because the Democratic Party, you'll never see from this day forward, because they changed their constitutional amendment, no one except the governor or that nominee can nominate the lieutenant governor. And I really think the whole election is going to be a hold your nose and vote.
All right.
Hello?
Kevin, go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry. No. If you look at Culver's record, he promised local control. He's never delivered. Branstad, yeah, right, on hog confinements. Branstad signed into law taking away local control over hog confinements and basically stripped the farmers of all their hogs and turned it into a corporate hog farm, you know, instead of family farmers. So, like I said, it's going to be a hold your nose and vote.
All right. Kevin, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it. I want to squeeze in one last one. We only have a minute. Jeffrey, what's your point from Des Moines?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I guess we're living in celebrity culture, and all the media discussion about this candidate, and no discussion or none that I saw of whether she has a college degree or whether she can write a complete sentence. You know, it's just interesting to me. The other thing I'm just going to quickly mention is Branstad wanting to abolish universal preschool education in Iowa and also tax cuts for out-of-state corporations. This doesn't seem economically the best road for Iowa.
All right, Jeffrey, thanks for the call. I'm going to look it up on the break. Does Kim Reynolds have a college degree, and does it matter? We're speaking on Talk of Iowa. This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck. Join us after this break. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. It's Politics Day. We're speaking with Rachel Caulfield, Drake University Professor of Politics and International Relations, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Before the break, we were speaking about Kim Reynolds, Lieutenant Governor pick of Terry Branstad, and someone had asked whether she had a college degree, so we did some quick fact-checking. She attended Southwestern Community College, then transferred to Northwest Missouri State, but did not complete her degree, and the campaign says she is committed to finishing that, but is not currently enrolled. world or taking classes, but wants to do that.
There
you go. Anyway, but we wanted to make sure we checked on that. We want you to join our conversation this morning, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we move on to a couple national issues, I feel like we ought to just mention the Culver Judge campaign because, you know, it's up and running and we're seeing ads from Chet Culver. Arnie, does he have his work cut out for him, or is it just the start of the season and he has plenty of time? I mean, the topic has been so focused on Republicans of late. Is that a bad thing or a good thing for Culver?
Well, no, that's a bad thing for Culver. But the problem is, you know, he's running in place in some ways. There's no change. There's no excitement in the base of the party. There's no anything. And what Branstad is able to do is he's able to sort of offer the fairy tale du jour, whatever that looks like. And Chet Culver has to look at an economy that's still in such incredibly tough shape. And you know what happens? It's called location, location, location. And even if you're not totally to blame for this, you are going to be blamed for this. What was the recent statistic that just came out that they said that last year approximately one-third of Americans had been without work, even though the numbers don't show it? That doesn't mean they didn't get another job, but that tells you how difficult it is. It is going to be difficult for any incumbent. Can I repeat that? Any incumbent. It's not a D or an R story. It's about being there. So I don't want people to think that this is a partisan conversation. It's every governor in the country is facing a very, very difficult time running against someone who is the new shiny coin. And, yes, he's got time, but I'm looking at what's happening in Washington, and I'm not sure what time's going to buy him.
Mm-hmm. And we just had a report released from the Legislative Services Agency, a nonpartisan group here in Iowa, that talked about how property taxes are going up more than $100 million because of, you know, budget cuts from the state prompted local school districts concerned about next year's budget to turn to property taxpayers. Rachel, uphill battle for Culver, or has he got time?
Uphill battle for Culver, and he has time. Very few people. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's. We're coming up on July 4th weekend. Nobody's paying attention to Culver right now. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, most people aren't going to pay close attention to a choice between Culver or Branstad until, you know, a few weeks before the election where they have to start making some hard choices. I want to just briefly, you know, Kevin's comment that this is a hold your nose and vote election. I think there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that feel that way. You know, I wouldn't call Terry Branstad the new shiny coin.
I think she meant others, but yeah, it does sound funny with him, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, his argument, though, remember that.
I know, absolutely. But this is Iowa, and they know Terry Branstad.
I know.
And so this race is a little bit different than I think races across the country.
It's going to be fascinating.
And I think Iowa voters are probably less enthused with their choices than maybe some folks are in other states.
I want to slip in an email before we move on from Bill in Ames, because he says, regarding Kim Reynolds' drunk driving problem, don't forget that Roxanne Conlon has admitted she's a recovering alcoholic.
Yep.
And has a DUI arrest on her record, and also that Iowa's greatest governor ever, Harold Hughes, this is Bill's words, not mine, had a serious alcohol problem, which he openly and frequently admitted. He said, you could... couldn't pay me to vote for Branstad Reynolds, but my vote has nothing to do with her DUI arrest.
And
that's
Richards,
from Bill and Ames.
Ann Richards, the governor of Texas, openly talked about her problems with alcohol and drugs and everything else, and she was considered a very good governor in Texas. And again, I think the idea that you get it out, which means you control it, it's not a gotcha moment, you've disclosed it, and I think people respect that. We all know that we have flaws in our character. The question is, did you change? Did you learn from them? Did you grow from them? Did you repeat the pattern? And I think that's where she's in the driver's seat now, not in the DUI seat, because she's been so open about it. And I think we all can appreciate that.
Yeah, I think the campaign has neutralized this for the most part.
I agree.
You know, before the holiday break for Congress, they are pushing like the dickens to try to get a financial reform bill through. Arnie, you sent me some interesting writings from Alan Sloan in the Washington Post, who says, with the rare exception or two, this 2,000-page bill nibbles at the toes of the problem. It doesn't go for the throat. Its sponsors just pretend it does. What do you see happening? Is this going to get done before they go home?
Well, there will be a bill. The question is, does the bill repair the problems that brought us to our financial knees in 2008 and 2009? And that's really
and
what the question
is.
And I don't know about you, Rachel, but this is so complicated and so difficult. And yet at the same time, what we're seeing is, for example, just in these last few days, the bill has gone back to conference. Why? Because the only Republicans that are willing to play in the sandbox are crafting huge, huge holes in this financial reform bill. And I'm referring to the two Republican women from Maine and Scott Brown from Massachusetts. And as much as a lot of the Republicans are not going to sign on to this bill, it's Republicans that are actually carving all the exceptions to this bill so that it's going to be more like financial deform than financial reform. And that is problematic. And you see Russ Feingold, who is this incredibly liberal Democrat from Wisconsin, saying, I'm not even going to vote for it because it doesn't remedy the problems that brought us here. How frustrating.
Yeah, and Rachel, one of the holdouts, Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, mm-hmm. is that going to look positive for him back here in Iowa, or is that going to look negative for him?
Well, this is one of those issues that, quite frankly, Iowans and citizens all across the country, we don't really understand. We don't really know what financial mm-hmm. policies got us into economic meltdown. We'd like them to be fixed, but we don't really know what that fix would look like. Mm-hmm. So, quite frankly, this is one of those bills that's far more symbolic from an electoral standpoint, far more symbolic. I think, you know, should Grassley ultimately vote against it, he could make, a pretty good case to a bunch of people who don't really understand the issue that this was a principled vote and that it was good for the state of Iowa. And the administration needs to pass a bill. Congress needs to pass a bill. Everybody needs to pass a bill. They're going to pass something. The debate right now and the decision to reopen the conference committee to tinker with the bill at this stage, you have a group of senators that are holding out support pending some determination of where the money will come from to pay for the provisions of the bill. And the idea was that money would come from a tax on banks, big banks that are doing mm-hmm. a lot of business and bringing in significant amounts of income. And Scott Brown really was the first to take the lead in saying, I can't support this. This isn't going to work for me. So now there's a deal that's being struck, or they think it's going to be struck, that would instead cut off the rescue funds, the TARP funds.
Yeah, the TARP funds.
To pay for the bill.
Right. But let me just say something. I listened to a Republican senator talking about the fact that, okay, we can't tax banks. So the idea is, okay, we're going to take the money that's being paid back from TARP to pay for this. And then my Republican senator, Judd Gregg, said, no, no, no. You are supposed to use that payback from TARP to deal with the deficit. This is such a shell game. I cannot stand it. The money's under this walnut. It's under that walnut. It's under this walnut. And how can you have a financial reform bill that has any teeth that isn't got funding? How can you have it? That means
you can't pass it without the funding right now.
So there's no enforcement capability. And once again, we're into this toothless mess. And I am going to recommend everyone to read an article. There's an article in Time magazine. And the irony of the article in Time magazine is that it's talking about the financial reform bill. And it starts with a firm in Massachusetts called State Street. It was supposed to be one of the safest banks in America, but ultimately it needed a $2 billion bailout because of its interesting behavior. They have just basically gotten a loophole in the financial reform bill that allows them to do exactly the same thing that caused us to write a check for $2 billion to bail them out. So this is where people need to at least understand something, because in the end, it is our tax dollars that are bailing out bad behavior. And if we are creating a new financial reform bill that allows them to repeat that, then tell me how we've moved ahead.
Well, at the same time, The problems for this bill are not that people are approaching it with ill will, or that that there are a bunch of malicious people out there who are trying to game the system and get what they want. The real problem, I think, is that this is an election year. Every member of Congress has citizens back home. They need those votes, and they want those votes. And so no single institution, every single bank is located somewhere. It's in somebody's congressional district. And so somebody's going to oppose a tax on that bank. Somebody's going to oppose any sort of measure that would restrict the ability of that bank to grow and hire local citizens. And right, so the structure, and it's not unique to this bill. It's unique to any major reform bill. And so we wonder why legislation comes out that doesn't really deal with the fundamental problems. But at heart, it's because the legislative structure is built in a way that doesn't allow for wholesale reform.
I want to get some of our callers in as well. If you want to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us at talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Don called 1-866-780-9100. Don from Iowa City, thanks for calling Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. I agree with what the commentator said about business. I mean, you have one party that's for small government and big business. But the other thing that I think is really undermining our economic recovery and our police protection and fire protection, our education system, is the cost of these bloody wars. I mean, what we're spending in Afghanistan and Iraq is just insane. And I think you can trace the decline in this country from the day we invaded Iraq.
And, Don, will that be an issue you vote on? I mean, will that drive your vote?
Oh, very much so.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
It's
is Don alone? Go ahead, Arnie. What?
As we're looking at now, Afghanistan being the longest war, and the American people losing any sense of sort of hope that there's some sort of positive end game for this, as we listen to Petraeus's, you know, quick endorsement by Congress to take over from McChrystal. And wars are expensive, but we are playing in so many arenas when it comes to war. And for whatever reason, that always is off the table when we look at the financial despair of the United States. And that's problematic. It just is, because I don't know. I don't see one party differing very much from the other, so I don't see very much in the way of choice.
You know, I should have asked, Don, because you do wonder, how do you vote on that issue?
Exactly.
The two parties haven't been that separate on that issue. One thing that struck me as Congress is trying to deal with this financial reform package, and you mentioned, Rachel, that not a lot of people really understand it. What they do understand is that unemployment benefits are running out.
Yep.
You know, more than 100,000 Iowans out of work. I'm trying to remember the number I just saw the other day. Are there 3 million in the country that are getting? No, that can't be. Maybe that's it. Do you know, Arnie, that are getting unemployment benefits right now that are about to lose those? I'm trying to remember the number off the top of my head, but point being, Republicans, you know, fought back an effort in the House yesterday to extend those benefits because it is becoming unpopular to do so.
But the undeserving unemployed, unemployed, of which a significant portion of them are over the age of 55. That means they probably own a house. They probably own a car. They probably have been paying into the schools for years. And they have been in the workforce for decades. They didn't choose the pink slip. To find the new skill sets is so difficult that it's just, you know, they're old. There's ageism. I just want to remind everyone, the undeserving unemployed, we are constantly looking for a scapegoat. The unemployed now are becoming the welfare queens with the pink Cadillac. That's exactly what's happening, and that is incredibly frightening, especially for some people I know who've been looking desperately for years for work, and the work just hasn't shown up. Very scary.
And, Rachel, then how does that play out? Because, you know, I suppose it depends, one, if you're one of those that lost your job, or if you know someone, if you had a friend who, you know, worked for a company for 20, 30 years that was ousted, and how you feel about those that are unemployed.
Yeah, there's... I mean,
will Congress look mean-spirited or like they're being tough?
Congress always looks mean-spirited. that's why they have a public approval rating that's abysmal. I think what this comes down to, all of this, I'm going to go back to Don's comment as well. I think what all of this comes down to is setting priorities, right? We have not been a country that has set our priorities well. So in the midst of two very expensive wars that have been going on, in the midst of an economic collapse that was at least in part due to faulty regulatory systems, you have this, you know, the situation where we have – too much demand for money, quite frankly, and not enough. Most Americans kind of see this through their own unemployment or through deployment overseas or what have you. But it gets overwhelming after a while. There have been a number of studies on voting behavior and how voters respond to economic conditions. And interestingly, they've found that voters actually don't vote based on their own economic circumstances. Instead, they vote on their general perception of how the economy is overall. So it's a bigger lens that they use. And I think right now a lot of voters are confused. They're getting conflicting messages about whether the economy is improving. And, you know, then we have home sales going down, and we have, like, nobody's quite sure exactly where we are in that cycle.
What that unemployment check does, for the most part, it isn't about a comfortable life, but it probably does mean they're paying the electric bill. It probably does mean they're paying the food bill. It probably means they are covering their very basic expenses. And that's really all they're covering. And if they have been unemployed for a significant period of time, they have dipped into whatever reserves they have, because the unemployment check doesn't even cover the cost of COBRA. It doesn't even cover the cost of COBRA for most people. So in the United States, when you lose your job, you are a hell of a lot more vulnerable than you are in most European nations, because you don't have universal health care coverage, because you don't have universal costs of coverage for higher education or for preschool or after school. You are much more vulnerable when you have lost your job. And for those who have been long-term unemployed, the intensity of the vulnerability just increases. So I just want to remind people that when you cut those individuals off, be prepared for there to be a ripple effect that affects you, because there are basic bills that won't be paid. And then the question is, especially at a local level, who's going to pick up the tab?
I want to try to squeeze in two more callers. John is calling from Oak Park. John, thanks for joining our conversation on Talk of Iowa today.
Well, I'd like to speak on drill, baby, drill. The last 5 years, we've been pumping more, you know, at home oil, but we're exporting it. And our big bottleneck isn't pumping the oil out. It's we haven't built a refinery in 70 to 100 years. And a lot of the refined gasoline, diesel is going to, of all places, Iran, who's even worse off in refineries. So here we are helping our supposed enemy with refined fuels, and we don't have enough refined. That drives up really the cost of gasoline. Maybe 30% of it is there isn't enough refineries. And another friend of the Republicans, the Red Chinese, they're supplying SAM-2 anti-aircraft missiles to Iran, who we at least say is our enemy, and they have also sent a special one called the Z-315, and it's a ground strike missile, and it can carry a 2,000-pound warhead, and it can also carry an atomic warhead and make
What do you want, though, then, John, out of that policy? What policy do you want to see changed?
Well, first of all, build more refineries.
Okay.
Quit exporting gasoline, and then make it clear, are we just doing shadow pay? The politicians are showing how tough they are, the terrorists of Iran, because if that's it, drop it. We don't need to make any more enemies, and if they really are big enemies, as the Republicans say, take them out.
All right, John, thanks for that call from Oak Park. Arnie, any chance that there's going to be more refineries, or is the feeling against oil too negative right now?
Like everything else, there's a whole NIMBY problem. Everybody wants more refineries.
Yes.
Well, the first town, please stand up. Please accept this refinery. And while you're at it, will you take a nuclear waste dump? I want to make sure. I think they're bookends. I mean, this is part of the problem, and part of the reason why I'm a sustainable energy nut is that, you know what, it is less frightening to have a solar facility next to you, a wind turbine in your backyard, than it is to have a refinery or a nuclear waste dump or a nuclear power plant. Is that, you know, we like the result, but we are afraid of how you get there. And and that's true on many, many levels. And now with this whole BP oil spill, people are saying, is this the time to do a refinery, or should we put our time, energy, and effort into looking for something else?
Yeah, right. And there people are also the NIMBY movement.
Not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard. You know, that general inclination, you know, as much as people can say, no, don't worry, the refinery will be safe. People look to the Gulf and they say, yeah, we don't really believe you.
Yeah. Let's squeeze in one more from Tom in Sioux City. Tom, I know we talked about this a while back, but I just want to squeeze you in because you, you're from Vanderplaat's hometown and you've got a viewpoint.
Yeah, there's two things. The first thing is the Drake should fire the professor that's talking because she doesn't even know that up in Sioux City and in Elk Point, South Dakota, Hyperion Resources from Dallas is trying to build a refinery to take to refine some of the tar sands into oil. And we want it in our backyard. Now, the other thing that you should... Now, the other thing is you guys are missing the point as plain as nose on your face. I'm a Republican, and I may not vote for Branstad, and I may not vote for Vanderplaat. Vanderplaat is probably going to run as a third party, and he's going to get, in effect, reelect Culver. And then what he's, the point of the movement behind what he's doing came... They said it in a clouded way from that Iowa Family Values thing that won't support Branstad. They're trying to show the rest of us moderate Republicans that the only way they can win is by going over to the other side because you're never going to get them to come over to us.
And gotcha. So they're forcing your hand.
It's called a lack of tolerance.
And the Drake should fire the lady because she doesn't know what she's.
I got to cut Tom off. We're out of time. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. Thanks for joining us today. The program is produced by Greg Shanley and Dennis Reese. We have our guest, Rachel Caulfield, Drake University Professor of Political Science and International Relations and New Hampshire Political Analyst Arnie Arneson. That's what happens when I hurry. Remember, you can get podcasting or on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks for listening this morning. This is Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you.